At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, political talk without the boring parts. I'm John Wiener. Today we'll try to catch up on all the news about Putin and Donald Trump Jr. We'll speak with Joan Walsh about that. We'll also talk about Trump's voting commission with Ari Berman, because if the Democrats are going to retake the House in November 2018, they're going to need to be able to vote. First up today, Al Franken, senator from Minnesota. Al Franken ran for the Senate for the first time in 2008. He won by 312 votes after a recount that lasted 8 months. Now he's a member of the Judiciary Committee, and of course he played a key role in exposing the lies of Attorney General Jeff Sessions about his contacts with Russians during the campaign. Today we want to talk about a new book. It's already a number one bestseller. It's called Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. The author is Al Franken. One note, in Minnesota, the Democratic Party is called the DFL, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. We spoke with Senator Franken over the weekend. Al Franken, we talked in 2003 about your book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. It was a number one bestseller. In that interview, you were really funny. You were hilarious. But then around 2008, you just stopped being funny. What happened? Was it problems at home, or what went wrong?
When I really stopped being funny was during the recount. That's when I completely lost my sense of humor. No, I was running for office, and I thought that comedy would be an asset. My career would have been an asset, but the Republicans right away just started putting everything I'd ever written or said through this $15 million machine called the Dehumorizer, and it had been built with advanced Israeli technology to take all the irony and context that any hyperbole and just suck it out and leave you with something offensive. And so I learned that it became very clear very early in that race that humor wasn't going to be the thing that you can't litigate comedy. And so I had to sort of say, okay, this is why I'm running, and let people know that I was serious about serving in the Senate and serving the people of Minnesota. And it worked, barely, but it worked. Norm Coleman, opponent, had been mayor of St. Paul and had run for governor and had lost to Jesse Ventura. So he's lost now to a professional wrestler and a comedian.
And Norm Coleman, how's he doing these days?
Yeah, people worry about him. Some people, you know, I beat him and people worry, but he's landed on his feet. He now continues to serve the people of Minnesota as a paid lobbyist for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Norm Coleman, I have a pet peeve about Norm Coleman because he started out as a anti-war student radical in the Vietnam era.
Yeah, he was SDS. Yeah.
Then he became a Democrat, a DFLer.
Right, and he was mayor of St. Paul as a DFLer, and then he switched in the middle and became Republican, and people change their views. People should be able to do that, and I'm not sure if it was because there was no Rhode Dyer office as a DFLer at that point or not, but he became Republican, and he did lose in a three-way race to Jesse Ventura, and so he's lost to a comedian and a professional wrestler, and I'm hoping that he runs one more time and loses to a human cannonball.
Okay. Well, I got the impression from your book that you don't like Ted Cruz very much.
Well, in the book, I talk about how much I do work with my Republican colleagues and how much I do like a number of them. But Ted is, I write a chapter on Ted because he's kind of the exception to the rule, which is that the rule is that to get things done in the Senate, you have to be collegial. And Ted's kind of a toxic coworker. He's kind of the guy who microwaves fish in the lunchroom. So I do write a chapter about him, and it's completely fair. I say at the beginning, as one thing you should know about Ted Cruz is that I like Ted Cruz probably more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz, and then I explain why.
What do you think about a political party whose final two candidates for the nomination are Ted Cruz and Donald Trump?
It's, you know, that's that it is interesting that they were the two finals standing, sort of. I mean, Kasich was in there too, but he didn't have a chance, and there's no doubt that Ted was second. And the fact that the establishment Republicans didn't get behind Ted says a lot about who he is as a person.
As I recall, there was only one senator who got behind Donald Trump.
Well, Sessions did. I mean, yeah. Sessions did early, and he's attorney general now. And we had one who got behind Ted Cruz, which was Mike Lee. Mm-hmm. And so neither of them were terribly popular. And I think the Trump voters liked that they weren't popular with establishment Republicans. I think Trump voters are mad both at they're just mad at government, big government, and think basically there's no difference between Republicans and Democrats. There's huge differences, but they didn't. They looked at big government as a self-serving entity that has no interest in their lives. And, you know, I understand how they feel that. I think they're wrong, but there are aspects of the way things work in Washington that they're right about, and very often it can be that these big corporate interests, capture regulatory agencies, and so they're. That's why the Bernie people and the Trump people, they're very often people voted for Bernie in the primaries, voted for Trump.
Very often?
I think so, or somewhat often. I do think so, and
Bernie.
There are a lot of people who voted for me in 2014 in Minnesota and voted for Trump in 2016.
Yeah, I want to talk about this because Bernie won the DFL caucus quite a bit. What did he get? He got 62%. Mm-hmm. You were not a Bernie supporter. Let's talk a little bit more about the Bernie supporters in Minnesota during the primary.
Well, there wasn't a primary.
In the caucus.
Well, there's a big difference. There's no perfect way to do all of this. There just isn't. But I think that the primaries make sense after the Iowa caucus. I think then the rest of the system should be primaries. There's a reason to have a caucus, which is that, if you just have primaries, if you just have a primary at the beginning, whoever has the most money can get on the air. But the Iowa caucus is you get the people, everybody in Iowa who cares about this expects to meet all the the candidates, at least, you know, and candidates should come in and fold your laundry and stuff like that so that you get to know them.
You are a trained lie spotter.
I am. I am. That's what I was part of what I do. And I kind of it was self-taught.
Would it be fair to call Jeff Sessions a lying little weasel?
I think that would be, you know, I don't think I would say that.
Well, if you Google Jeff Sessions and lying little weasel, you get 30 million results.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's that's not how I would characterize the Attorney General of the United States. I do think that he answered one of my questions by not answering it, and said, since I asked him if it turned out that members of the Trump campaign had continuous communications with Russians during the campaign, what would he do? Meaning, would he recuse himself? And he said, I haven't had I had no connections or communications with the Russian
campaign,
and he did.
And this is a lie. It's a lie under oath. Lying under oath to Congress, this is a crime. People have gone to jail for lying under oath to Congress.
Yeah, and I would like him, his written responses to why he answered the way he did were not at all satisfactory. And his opening statement at the Senate Intelligence Committee's hearing where he testified was very unsatisfactory to me. I want him to come before the committee again, and he is the head of the Justice Department. We're the Judiciary Committee. We have oversight over the Justice Department. He should be appearing before us, and I will. You know, there sometimes people give false testimony for a reason other than that they're lying. And so that's what, you know, I have not been satisfied with his I think his answers about why he answered the way he did and his characterization of it have also been inaccurate and false. So he's in a deep hole as far as I'm concerned.
And the result of your questioning of Jeff Sessions was that we got Robert Mueller, special counsel, investigating many things. And we want to give you credit for the prosecutorial brilliance of your questioning here.
Well, again, it's weird because I asked – he answered a question I didn't ask. But a lot of people kind of give me credit for like that Franken. He's clearly playing three-dimensional chess and is four moves ahead of everybody else. That was brilliant. And that wasn't really – I didn't try to trap him. It wasn't a gotcha question. It was simply, would you recuse yourself if it turns out – and instead of answering that question, he said, I didn't meet with the Russians. And when it turned out he did, about 7 weeks later in the Washington Post, and the fact that he didn't correct that in the 7 weeks was damning, and that's when he recused himself. So, you know, and then when he recused himself, Rosenstein became the effective head of that, and they fired Comey, and because Comey was fired, they got a special prosecutor. And so... You're welcome.
Okay. What you started in Lies and the Lying Liars was you had a team of researchers check the claims made by Fox News, by people like Bill O'Reilly, and show that they were wrong. This has now become a full-time industry of the mainstream media. The New York Times ran that whole page showing that Trump had lied every day. But as a trained lie spotter, you would die of overwork if you devoted those talents to all the lies Donald Trump tells. What do you make of Trump's lying and of the fact that his supporters don't seem to mind it when people like you show that these are lies?
Yeah, well, I don't really bother too much with that anymore. I mean, I think it's kind of adorable that I made a living pointing out that people were lying, that about right-wing lies. You're right. It doesn't matter anymore. And I think that, you know, people in the United States now have self-sorted and kind of live in communities where people think like they do. And they get their information. I mean, Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations is about talk radio to a great degree. And Lies and Lying Liars, You Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right was about Fox. And it was about other Republicans who lie. People get their information from the sources that confirm their own bias. And so a lot of people just either they, you know, a lot of his supporters would say, like, you know, don't take what he says literally. You know, you just got to understand what he's basically saying and take him seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, so there was that excuse about lying. But I think there's also other people who literally buy this fake news thing, which is ironic because the fake news first became a term because of what the Russians essentially were doing. This is feeding this fake news after they had hacked us and weaving these fake narratives, the pizza parlor where John Podesta and Hillary Clinton had a pedophile ring. So I do think that a lot of people get their information from places that they choose to get their information from. So it's a much, much harder to break through to correct things that are false these days.
Some of my friends think even if everything we suspect about the Trump campaign's collusion with Russians, that all that is true, that it's still a mistake for the Democrats to focus on this. What the Democrats need to focus on, the argument goes, is the real reasons they lost the election and what it's going to take to win back those white working class men in, you know, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and a lot of them in Minnesota. And the Democrats should be talking about a big infrastructure program, about health care for all, about free college, and not focus so much on Russian hacking. What do you think about that argument?
I think you can chew gum and walk at the same time. And I actually do agree that the intelligence committees in both the House and the Senate should be focused on what happened in terms of the Russian hacking and working on and what we can do to prevent it from happening again. I think that – and we have Robert Mueller, who I think is the right guy as a special prosecutor. And let him go. He'll go where the facts take him. And so we have that in place, I guess, thanks to me. So so I agree with that. We should be really speaking to those people who have, you know, I think legitimate beefs with life for the last 40 years, the squeeze on the middle class, the corporate, you know, a capture of the courts, the Trump election didn't help on any of these scores. Yeah. You saw that, you know, the people going to be most hurt by the Senate health care bill and the House health care bill would be people in the very people who voted for Trump, or a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. But they have reasons to distrust the government, and I think we have to pay attention to that. You know, they think that big government is self-serving, and that's not untrue in many ways. And Sheldon Whitehouse has written a great book called Captured, and it basically talks about, you know, how they Citizens United means that they've captured campaign finance and our election system, and they appoint justices who allow that and who make it impossible for people to get into a courtroom because of mandatory arbitration. Mm-hmm. And that they capture regulatory agencies, and because of the revolving door where you go from regulatory agency into a private company and get paid big bucks. And the idea that people distrust in Trump country distrust big government, the idea that, like, to scoff at that is just wrong. And that's, I think, why there was overlap between Bernie and Trump, and why there are people who voted for me and who voted for Trump. So, no, I agree with you. And I think one of the things we have to do is go to those people and listen. I think listening is a good idea for a politician.
Of course, we're all preoccupied with health care bill, what's going to happen in the Senate, what's going to happen in the country. Do you think it's time? Do you think we're moving towards a single-payer system or something like Medicare for All?
You know, I talk about health care. I have a chapter on health care, and I talk about what the approach was in 2009. And there were some of us who were for single payer, and Bernie was leading that. But I mentioned that you had to get 60 votes, and we were about 50 votes short. And so what we were trying to do is, my opponent Norm Coleman at the time would say, we have the best healthcare system in the world, in the United States, and the proof of it is we have the Mayo Clinic here in Minnesota. And I'd point out the Mayo Clinic isn't a healthcare system; it's a hospital and clinic. And T.R. Reid wrote a book on all the healthcare systems in the world, and basically said, we in the United States, we don't have a healthcare system. We have lots of systems. If you're in Medicare, you're in the Canadian system. If you're in the military, if you're in the VA, you're in the British system. You're in socialized medicine. If you are getting through your employer, you're in the German system that Bismarck started. If you don't have insurance, you're in the Cambodian system. And what ACA tried to do is get people in the Cambodian system into one of the others, either in the Canadian or into the German system, and succeeded to a great extent in doing that. What we need to do, I'm hoping this bill goes down. I've been doing everything I can to fight the Senate bill and the House bill. Minnesotans in rural Minnesota don't like this bill. 17% of Americans support this Senate bill. That's the exact number of Americans who have said they have seen a ghost. And they don't like it for a reason, which is that this is taking health care away from people who need it. People on Medicaid generally are working people. There are some people who are disabled. There are people who are in nursing homes. More than about 60-some percent, 64%, I think, of people in nursing homes have that paid for by Medicaid. Half the births are paid in the country, Medicaid. And these rural hospitals really, really have benefited from the expansion of Medicaid and would be terribly hurt by all the uncompensated care that would happen, come from all these people who would become uninsured because of this bill and would go to the emergency room. Yeah. And you'd see these hospitals have to either lay off a lot of people. Very often they're the largest employer in a county. Mm-hmm. Would have a terrible economic impact on the county, and sometimes they would close because of this. So hopefully we will, if this doesn't go through, I hope that we can work in regular order, go through the committee process to shore up the exchanges. I would love a public option.
You would love a public option.
Yeah, I was for a public option. Again, we needed 60 votes, and we were short on that. We had a few Democrats. I mean, Harry Reid had 60, so everyone had a veto. Unfortunately, yeah. At one point, we were going to lower Medicare to 55, and that would have been very good. And Joe Lieberman kind of squashed that. Because you needed every member of the caucus. So I hope we do a bipartisan effort to fix the things that are not working right now in our healthcare system. And that means the exchanges, also pharmaceutical costs, which I have a very comprehensive bill to address.
Last question. You're extremely successful as a book author. I found a webpage that shows you have sold more books than anyone in the Senate.
I mean, look, there are good books from senators, but by and large, the political memoir is not the most exciting genre that publishing has produced.
Only a few people in politics have sold more books than you. I just want to mention a couple of them. The Audacity of Hope, number one bestseller. Mm-hmm. Author went on to become president.
Sure.
Art of the Deal, huge number one bestseller. Author went on to become president.
And Tony Schwartz is president?
Very good. Al Franken, giant of the Senate, number one bestseller. You see where I'm going with this.
Yeah, this is 2020. I've been very flattered in this book tour. People have been saying, I think who's ever president should really, really, really want to be president. I've seen the presidency closer up as a senator than I thought I would see when I was a comedian. And it's an incredibly difficult job. And tremendous pressure. And, people say, well, you'd be better than Donald Trump. And I go, well, yeah, but that's no reason that someone should be president. And they like the book or they like what I've been doing in the Senate. And it's very, very flattering. But certainly I'm not considering that.
The book is Al Franken, Giant of the Senate. The author is Al Franken. Senator Franken, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, this has been a great pleasure.
It's been a big week for news about the Trump campaign's collusion with Russia, probably the biggest yet. For comment, we turn to Joan Walsh. She's a political analyst on MSNBC. She wrote the book, What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America. And she's national affairs correspondent for The Nation. We reached her today in New York City. Joan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John.
Well, we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, and who knows what Wednesday and Thursday will bring. But at this point, fill us in on what we know about Donald Trump Jr. meeting with that Russian lawyer during the campaign, a person with Kremlin connections who said she had compromising information about Hillary Clinton.
Oh, we know so much and so little, in the sense that they tell the truth about some of it, but then we're not sure if they're telling the truth about other parts of it. But let me try to walk you through it. On Saturday, the New York Times just revealed the details of a meeting with this woman, Natalia Veselnitskaya, who has been close to Putin's friends. And Trump Jr. tried to argue at first, he keeps changing his story, that they only talked about Russian adoption policy and he didn't really have time to deal with it. Well, then the next day, the Times revealed that the meeting was taken because this woman promised incriminating dirt gathered by the Russian government on Hillary Clinton. Then Donnie changed his story and it was completely incoherent. And finally, on Tuesday, the Times did report that they reported on the actual wording of an email from a Trump crony with major Putin ties.
So the email that Don Jr. released says that he is offered a meeting where a woman who is, quote, a Russian government attorney, close quote,
right,
has documents that, quote, would incriminate Hillary, close quote. And most amazing of all, the email that Don Jr. released said, this, quote, is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, close quote.
Just part. Just part of it, you know.
Just part. We've been told for months by everyone connected with the Trump White House and the Trump campaign that there's no evidence of collusion. I think we're done with that now.
I think we're done with that. And you know, also the claims that if there was, they didn't know about it. We're done with that. I just keep thinking that even while we're on the phone, more shoes will drop, because that's been the nature of this story in over the last 2.5 days. So we're definitely in a place where a lot of people think laws have been broken, as in foreign nationals are not allowed to contribute anything of value, quote, anything of value, not just money, but anything of value. And presumably dirty info about Clinton would be of value. And Americans are not allowed to accept it. So that law seems to have been broken, although who can prosecute, who would prosecute, there are a lot of questions about that. But I feel like this is just the beginning of a torrent of revelations coming mainly from within the Trump White House, because the really interesting thing about the Times revelations on, I think it was Sunday night, I'm losing track, was that they were sourced to three White House advisors and two government officials who were familiar with the documents. Three White House advisors, John, what does that even mean? I mean, somebody's trying to get Junior to be the fall guy. I don't know. I shouldn't go out on a limb. But it's crazy right now.
Don Jr. has said that what happened at this meeting was that it quickly became clear that the Russian woman attorney had no information about Hillary and that it came to nothing, and therefore nothing of value was exchanged, is the implication. And there's nothing wrong with a meeting where nothing happened. What do you say to that defense?
He at least tried to solicit something of value from a foreign national.
The keyword here is intent. His intent.
Right. He intended to.
Do you believe the people who say that Donald Trump himself had no knowledge of this meeting?
Everything I know of young Don Jr. and his closeness to his father and his desire for his father's approval and his father's closeness to these two Putin-connected Russian moguls who were promising the help, the Agalarovs, tells me that Donnie would run over from the next office and say to Daddy, "Hey, I've got look at what our friends are offering us. I've got a meeting today." I just don't believe that that didn't happen. And the same day that, you know, this meeting occurred, I guess it was June 9th, 2016, a little over a year ago, the very same day, like an hour after the meeting happened, Donald Trump himself, Sr., started tweeting for the first time about Hillary Clinton's missing 33,000 emails and how incriminating they were going to be. Now, you know, let's stop there and admit nothing in this email thread talked about those emails or talked about any of the actual things that the intelligence community believes the Russians did.
You're saying we, despite all the incredible revelations of the last few days, the most devastating of the entire year, that we still do not really know what happened at that meeting between the Russian lawyer and Don Jr., Jared, and Paul Manafort. Is that right? We still don't really know?
Yeah, we absolutely do not know. I mean, you know, it's going to be interesting if Bob Mueller, the independent counsel, gets some other people to talk. I mean, the folks we haven't heard from are Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort.
You used the phrase, another shoe is likely to drop. I just want to note that John McCain commented on
I saw that.
Tuesday morning, more shoes will drop, he said, on this centipede.
Yeah, that means 100 shoes. Senator McCain delivers the best sound bites, and God bless him, but Republicans are doing nothing about this. And, you know, the most disliked senator, according to our friend, Senator Al Franken, is Ted Cruz. And Ted Cruz, even though Donald Trump insulted both his wife and his father, has emerged as one of his biggest defenders, calling this a, quote, nothing burger and saying no one in Texas cares at all about it. I mean, that's pretty awful. All of this is indication that the Trump campaign has lied repeatedly about what they knew and also what they did. But you need Republican leaders who want to stand up and say, this is illegal, immoral, politically wrong. It rises to high crimes and misdemeanors, and they're not going to anytime soon. I don't know what it's going to take, but that's what's really depressing about this. We can raise a ruckus, and we should raise a ruckus. We shouldn't say because Republicans won't do anything right now, we're not going to agitate. But it is pretty clear to me watching the reaction of Democrats and then watching the reaction of congressional Republicans today that, it's going to take so much more than this, John, for them to stand up.
Joan Walsh, read her at thenation.com, where she asks the question, did Don Jr. just become the fall guy? Joan, obviously we're going to keep coming back to you on this as the other shoes on the centipede continue to drop. But thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
It's not easy to turn away from all the breaking news about Don Trump Jr.'s meeting with that Russian to get dirt on Hillary. But the big picture is this. If the Democrats are going to retake the House next November, they need to be able to vote. And the Trump administration's commission on what they call electoral integrity is working to make that a lot harder. For an update, we turn to our man on voting rights, Ari Berman. He wrote the award-winning book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He's been a senior contributing writer at The Nation magazine and a fellow at The Nation Institute. He also writes for The New York Times, Rolling Stone, The Guardian. He's a frequent guest and commentator on MSNBC and NPR. Ari, welcome back.
Hey, John. Good to talk to you again.
Well, let's start with what we've learned about Russian hacking of voting in the election last November. That's the subject of your cover story in the new issue of The Nation magazine. What have we learned?
Well, there's still a lot we don't know, but what intelligence agency officials have testified is that Russian hackers attempted to infiltrate and targeted 21 different states' election systems. So again, we don't know exactly what that means. We don't know if they got into voter registration rolls. We don't know what, if anything, they were able to do with voting machines. Two states have been identified where hackers were successful. One was Illinois, where they were able to steal the records of 90,000 registered voters, and the other was Arizona, where they attempted to breach the registration list via a county-level infiltration. So I would like us to be able to know more about this. I would like there to be more declassified information about what actually happened. But clearly, this is just the first step, I think, in hackers becoming more acquainted with the American election system and preparing. What I'm worried about is that they're now trying to prepare for an even broader attack on our election systems in 2018 or 2020.
Hacking into 21 different states' election systems, how does this compare with hacking John Podesta's emails or the DNC emails, which, of course, were posted on WikiLeaks at that key moment in the campaign?
Well, I view the hacking of election systems as a far more serious threat, because emails are one thing. Things that people use to register to vote or to vote on get to the heart of America's election process, and whether Russia did it this time or someone else does it another time, what my piece looked at is just how vulnerable our system is, how insecure our voting systems and other stuff are, how easy it would be for hackers to try to access registration data, how they could change voters' information to screw up the rolls in any number of ways. For example, like in states with strict voter ID laws, where your driver's license or some other photo identification has to match on your name on your voting rolls almost exactly, if you just changed one or two letters in everyone's name, that could prevent thousands of people from being able to cast a regular ballot. So these are the kind of nightmare scenarios that I'm worried about, and that a lot of other people who study American election systems are worried about as well.
Well, the little that we know about this is the statement from, includes a statement from our intelligence agencies saying no votes were changed or altered by Russian hacking. Do you think that's true?
Well, there's no evidence that any votes were changed, but unfortunately, there's not any evidence to suggest that they weren't changed either, meaning that DHS said they had not conducted a forensic analysis of any of the voting machines. I asked multiple election experts how confident they were that no votes were changed, and what they told me was it's impossible to know, which isn't to suggest a conspiracy theory that somehow all of these voting machines were hacked. What it is to say is that 14 states vote on electronic voting machines with no paper trails. So if there was a hacking, it might be very difficult to detect it. Meanwhile, the other 36 states have some sort of paper backup, but they don't check that paper regularly enough to compare the results. So we have some basic protections in place, but if we were really targeted with a massive cyber attack on our election systems, we are very, very vulnerable. And given what happened in 2016, it's extremely disturbing. We haven't done anything to protect our election system going forward.
Are we sure that the Russians did it? Trump has tweeted, quote, "I strongly pressed President Putin twice about Russian meddling in our election. He vehemently denied it," close quote. Your comment?
Well, if that's like asking a mobster if he killed someone. You know, he's probably not going to admit it unless he absolutely has to. I have no reason to dispute what the intelligence community is saying about this. Their findings are unanimous that it was the Russians. Meanwhile, intelligence officials going to Capitol Hill and saying it was the Russians while they're serving in the Trump administration puts them at great personal risk. So people from the FBI, people from the Department of Homeland Security, people from the CIA who are currently serving in the government, when they're testifying that it was Russia that hacked us, that's only going to make Trump angry. So if anything, they have a built-in incentive to say it wasn't the Russians. And they're saying quite the opposite.
You said that one of the things that an adversary could do would be to change the voter registration rules in states where strict ID is required that would prevent thousands of people from voting. Would it be possible, or what would it take to prevent Russians from changing the actual results on the machines? How hard would it be for us to prevent that from happening?
It would be harder, but not impossible, to access the machine. So the registration lists sit on a bunch of different computers, so it's easier to hack the registration lists. The machines themselves are not connected to the internet, but what I learned reporting this piece is that when the machines are programmed, because you have to program every machine, they often are connected to computers that are connected to the internet. So that's how you'd have to do it, or you'd have to physically get access to some of these machines. So it's more difficult, but certainly not impossible for someone who has a lot of technological sophistication with hacks.
I read that 42 states use Windows XP for their voting system. I think we were supposed to stop using Windows XP in 2014. Have I got that right?
Well, so a bunch of voting machines were bought after the 2000 election in Florida, after the hanging chad and butterfly ballot debacle. And these machines were supposed to last for 10 to 15 years, meaning they have all basically expired by now. But states haven't spent money to buy new voting machines. And this is extremely problematic because, first off, the old software is totally primitive. It's easier to hack. And second thing, I mean, it could just melt down regardless of a hack. If machines break down, that leads to long lines, that leads to skepticism about the results, that leads to difficulty counting the results accurately. We saw this in Detroit in the last election where tons of machines just broke down. Like a third of the city had broken down voting machines, and it led to big problems on election day. So I think it's absolutely insane that we're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on a quote-unquote election integrity commission when there's no evidence of voter fraud whatsoever in American elections, but we can't even get a few million dollars to the states to upgrade their voting machines and create a paper trail. I mean, it's totally unconscionable.
Yeah, the figures that I saw in the New York Times was replacing all the old electronic voting machines that produce no paper trail. That's 14 states, according to the New York Times, with new machines that would have auditable returns would cost something like $130 million, maybe as much as $400 million. Is that a lot in terms of the federal budget?
It's not a lot in terms of the federal budget, and it's certainly not a lot when our elections cost billions of dollars, and we don't even have confidence that the machines that are counted in will work accurately or will not be hacked. So to me, this needs to be the number one priority.
Well, luckily for us, we already have a presidential commission charged with investigating election integrity and recommending ways to improve it. This is the President's Commission, headed by Mike Pence and Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach. What's your assessment of their work at this point?
Well, my assessment of the commission is that it's totally pointless. There's absolutely no evidence to suggest that millions of people voted illegally, as Donald Trump tweeted, and that's the only reason we have this commission in the first place, and it's focused on the absolutely wrong problem. We should be looking at election hacking and the vulnerability of our voting system, and also at voter suppression laws all across the country that made it harder to vote in 2016 and their impact on voter participation. We've had many, many, many studies now of voter fraud. It's an extremely rare problem in American elections. To the extent that it occurs, it's regularly caught. Election officials themselves will say this is not a big problem. We have much, much, much bigger problems. And my fear is that the Election Integrity Commission is going to spread this gigantic lie about voter fraud, which is that millions of people voted illegally, or at least a very large number of people voted illegally. And then because of that, we have to put in place all of these steps that make it more difficult to vote, all of these new restrictions to make it more difficult to vote, while doing nothing to actually make our election system more secure and actually preserve the integrity of our election systems, which many people are doubting after the 2016 election.
Ari Berman, we've always ended our segments with Ari saying, read him at thenation.com. And indeed, he's on the cover of the magazine and he has a piece at thenation.com this week. But this is the last time we'll be able to say read him at thenation.com on our podcast because Ari is moving to Mother Jones. Ari, we will miss you. Thanks for all your great work here and congratulations on the new job.
Thanks, John. And never say never. I'm sure I'll talk to you again.
Okay. Start Making Sense, the Nation podcast, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded at the studios of Emerson College Los Angeles by Ernesto Orellano, with additional technical assistance from Justin Allen. Alan Minsky is our senior producer, Frank Reynolds is our executive producer, Annie Shields is our engagement editor, Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. Find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts at SoundCloud, Stitcher, or iTunes. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.